This is a conversation with Mr. Williams, who is a lawyer in Nashville, Tennessee, Mr. Avon Williams, February 13. It picks up pretty well. It has about an 8-foot, 10-foot range for a normal voice.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Where were you born, Mr. Williams? Let's start with a few vital statistics.
Knoxville, Tennessee. December 22nd, 1921.
You're a lot younger than I am. Yeah. I was born in 1905.
Well, not that much younger.
And you educated where, sir?
Primary and secondary education in Knoxville, Tennessee, in the segregated Negro schools there. College, Johnson C. Smith University, Charlotte, North Carolina, a segregated Presbyterian college. Law school, Boston University, Boston, Massachusetts.
Yes. Do you know why Boston University has had so many Negroes as students?
I do not know why, of my own knowledge, because I never discussed it with any university official. However, I have gathered, and my experience there, I think, verified that Boston University has been very liberal. And when I say liberal, I mean in the sense of disregarding ethnic differences in people in terms of their admissions and their treatment of people after admission.
I know, but I'm acquainted with a great many Negroes who have been there,
yes,
either as undergraduates or in postgraduate way.
Well, as a matter of fact, my enrollment in Boston University is a right interesting story. When I was a senior in college, I wanted very much to go to Harvard Law School, although I might not have been admitted to Harvard anyway. But I did write to Harvard for an application, and they sent me a letter saying that Johnson C. Smith was not on their approved list. I was very young, and I went to see the dean of the college at Johnson C. Smith, and he suggested to me that instead of trying to do anything about getting Johnson C. Smith on the approved list, why didn't I make application to Boston University, which was his alma mater.
Yes,
and
yes.
So I did, and that combined with the circumstance that the tuition was less expensive at Boston University caused me to finally end up there.
Did you settle into practice here immediately on leaving law school, or were you somewhere else first?
My first experience in the practice of law was in Nashville. Completing my legal education in 1948, I was persuaded by my folks to return to Tennessee, and I had heard a great deal of Mr. Luby, so I wrote him about coming down here, and as a matter of fact, came down for an interview. As a result of that, I did spend 6 months with Mr. Luby in the year 1948-49 on an intern basis, and then I returned to Knoxville in September of 49 and initiated my practice there alone, and remained there until February of 1953, when I returned to Nashville to associate with Mr. Luby.
Were you in the war?
I was. Mm-hmm. I was drafted in 1943, February of 1943, the 9th of February, as a matter of fact, and was separated in August of 1946. So approximately 2.5 years overseas service.
Did the war experience, as in the case of so many other people, have some effect on you and your attitude toward the civil rights situation? Or was that fixed beforehand, or did it become fixed afterwards, part of your a significant part of your convictions and career?
I would say that anyone born in the South and reared in the South would have any Negro with any power of intellectual discrimination at all would have to have some rather fixed attitudes long before the age that I went into the Army, which was 21 years of age. I would say, however, that some of my attitudes were intensified by reason of the experience in the Army, in a segregated Army, and in some instances in places where the discrimination was just rather open, in addition to the discrimination in terms of segregated organizations, units, and that sort of thing. Such things as PXs being closed to certain types of, to certain races of people and that sort of thing. Yes, I would say service in the armed forces did intensify some of the attitudes that I had already developed as a result of my experience as a Southerner in the South.
That's go to, for a moment to the matter of the Nashville sit-ins and the boycott. How did the sit-ins arise? How did that happen? How much was that organized and how much was spontaneous?
I frankly do not know how the sit-ins arose.
Uh-huh.
I had read very little of the movement prior to the time that it happened. I knew nothing whatsoever of the organization of the movement prior to the time that it happened. I had, of course, read in passing of the Greensboro incidents a few days before the eruption in Nashville. However, I had no idea that it was going to occur in Nashville, and I was as surprised as anyone else when the news came out on, I believe it was on a Saturday, either the 17th or the 27th, I forget which day of February 1960, when they had the mass arrests here. I believe it was the 27th, and we were called into it to represent that.
You have been active, of course, a long time in civil rights and NAACP, is that
yes,
right?
In the NAAC, in connection with NAACP activities, legal defense, and that sort of thing. Your initial remarks were interesting to me because, as a matter of fact, when I finished, I said all through law school, and when I finished law school, I said that I was not interested in civil rights as an area of legal endeavor. I recall I have a cousin who was an active lawyer in the area of civil rights with the NAACP, an older established lawyer. And of course, when my folks persuaded me to come back to Tennessee, I said, well, I don't know what I can find to do here. And my father said, well, why don't you be an NAACP lawyer? And I said, I don't want to be an NAACP lawyer. I just want to be a lawyer. I want to practice. I don't want to be a Negro lawyer. I want to practice law. But one could hardly even intern with Mr. Luby without developing some sense of obligation in this area. And I think that probably began this. And then when I returned to Knoxville, Mr. Carl Cowan, who had been a stellar figure in that area as a lawyer representing people in this area, he was chairman of the Legal Redress Committee of the NAACP there, and he asked me to serve as a member. And of course, I couldn't turn that down, and Then we very soon got involved in the University of Tennessee days, and it just kept on going.
That is, it's a pattern one encounters very often, the person whose ambitions and aspirations have no relation to the civil rights, and somehow is then suddenly in it.
Yes, that's correct. Well, I suppose it's sort of like Mr. White, a lawyer who has an office here on the same floor, is a graduate of Howard Law School. And he says that when he was, Howard, of course, is the place where Thurgood Marshall was educated, and what the people we think of as being the great, the Negro legal greats like Charlie Houston and Andy Ransom and Jim Mabert and others either taught or attended school. And White was there during that time, and he says that he doesn't see how anyone could attend school at Howard without being imbued with a sense of obligation, that is law school, obligation and duty participate in this aspect of legal activity. And so I suppose that in a sense you could broaden this out and say that any Negro who has lived in the United States and seen what goes on must have a very poor sense of obligation or duty if he doesn't sooner or later, whatever he may be, come up against some situation that involves him actively in this field and which he can't turn down.
Well, Robert Moses told me he was in graduate school in Harvard studying philosophy. Two or three years, moving to his PhD, and walks away from that into Mississippi. Sudden change of direction, almost immediate. He wanted to be a professor of philosophy.
Yes, that is interesting. I didn't know that.
Yes, he told me the other day. I had a long session with him, this sort, three-hour talk with him.
But I suppose you've talked with Martin Luther King.
Not yet. I haven't. Well, I've talked with Mr. Abbott, with Dr. Abernathy. I've had a long session. I'm going back again to Atlanta and have a session with Dr.
King. Well, I don't know Dr. King personally, but from what I read about him, he falls in that same category.
Yes. Two accidents.
Yes.
Trapped him. Let me ask you a question that I have ran into it first long ago in reading Du Bois. He says that there's a dilemma for many Negroes, a real split in the psyche, for many, if not for all. Well, of course, not for all. On one hand, the pull toward, Africa, mystique of blackness, the sense of community in the experience of the Negro in America, the sense of a Negro culture, a Negro tradition, a Negro involvement, all these loyalties. What we now find is negritude and the black mystique and these things that are emerging in the African picture, and here in the most extreme form in the black Muslims. And on the other hand, the impulse to identify with the Western cultural tradition, Western European cultural tradition, the American aspect of it too, and to move toward that, to embrace that, and to be integrated with that, and perhaps eventually absorbed into that stream, not culturally, but in the bloodstream of Western European American world, with the loss of identity, absorption and loss of it, the loss of continuity as special, as Negro. This, for some Negroes, is a real problem, as it is for some Jews. The question of maintaining the Jewish, not necessarily religious, but cultural fidelities in the face of the pull toward the Western European Christian tradition, or post-Christian tradition. Does this present itself to you as an issue or not?
Well, yes, I
although I don't know whether I would consider it very much of an issue. I believe that people are taught things after they are born. I don't, for instance, I believe that here in the United States, here in the South, for instance, I believe that white people are taught by their own people and by themselves an in-group preference. They are taught to love white people and to think that white people are beautiful and to think that white people are intelligent. And in fact that they embody all the desirable attributes of life. Negroes, on the other hand, from the time they are babies, are taught not only by white people, but by their own people, that there is something dirty about them, that there is something substandard about them.
About themselves, you mean?
About themselves. And they consequently have what has been called an out-group preference. It's amusing that many Negroes who've been characterized as among the most militant can sometimes catch themselves doing things and saying things that are a part of this early training, which can be described in substance by the phrase "white is right." What the white man says or what he does is a thing that should be emulated. And of course, I think Dr. Du Bois is right in this sense that the ego in the individual certainly rebels against this sort of training and this sort of indoctrination. It rebels at some point along the line. Sometimes a man is an old man before he all of a sudden realizes that this is, after all, a whole lot of junk. And many people maybe go to their graves never realizing it. Maybe this is one of our problems in the South today. But as I see it, this is not so much a problem or an issue of psyche as it is an issue of a problem of training and just straight training and indoctrination. And I'm just afraid, of course, the black Muslims represent an application of this same type of training in reverse. In other words, doing the same thing except doing it the other way. And it may be that the world needs something like that. It may be that the only way that white people can be taught that they are not, after all, the essence of perfection is to be exposed to a world in which the majority of people in power look some other way and act some other way and talk some other way and discriminate against them in the same way that they have discriminated against the Negroes and have the power to teach them in the same way that they have attempted to teach colored peoples to hate themselves. It may be that they require this. I don't think that they require this. I do think that Negroes, to some extent, those Negroes who've been exposed to this, and maybe in the present situation this has to be, even with regard to white people, the Negroes do need to come to the realization that, after all, black is beautiful. That black people are beautiful. That, for instance, we ourselves say the picture looks black. And when we say it looks black, then we mean the picture is unpleasant. And, for instance, right now, I am having to undergo a conscious course of self-indoctrination to eliminate these expressions from my vocabulary.
Get rid of the symbolisms that are...
Yes, I'm having to teach myself to remember that black, after all, is a warm color. That the connection of light with knowledge and black with sin is a man-made connection, not a God-made connection. That we could have it just the other way around for that matter. So I, with regard to Africa, of course, I think I've dealt with what you were driving at, what you were saying, what you were suggesting, that Dr. I wasn't familiar with that particular book of Dr. Du Bois. But I think what you were saying was that he was saying that the Negro is pulled two ways.
That's right.
Well, I think actually the Negro is actually pulled one way. He's pulled towards the white culture of which he's a part. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with the Negro submitting himself to a pull towards the culture of which he's a part. But when that culture teaches him that he is inferior, teaches a majority group and which is one of its component parts, that it is superior, then this does create a problem for him.
That's a very astute formulation, I think. It's a very different formulation from the other one, isn't it?
Well, I don't know whether it's so astute,
yes.
I think it's astute.
Yes. There's a lawyer that I talked to in New Orleans a week or 10 days ago, who's a man of the highest quality intellectually and personally, and has been very active in civil rights in New Orleans, in Louisiana. He said to me, on this general point...
Was that Mr. Durrell?
No. He said to me, I hate to say it, it's being forced on me by my experience, that... I don't see how the white man can be changed. He says, I am moving toward the black Muslim position. He says, I'm actually reading their literature now. This is a man who's not the ordinary type that goes to the black Muslim at all, you know, from the dregs of the outcasts. This man has a successful law practice, and it's against all my philosophy. He says, I'm beginning to feel this emotional drag toward it and the conviction that they are right. The white man is unredeemable.
Well, of course, I could not agree with this. If you intend by that to ask me what my thinking would be in regard to that.
Well, I hope what your response is to that. I report this. This is a man that he says against all my philosophy. He said, and all my beliefs, but this is beginning to take hold of me.
Well, I wonder if that man has read...
My past philosophy, my past philosophy.
I wonder if he has read anything about what the black Muslims propose. I don't say that I have read everything or even a great deal of it, but I do understand that one of their ideas is that segregation is a natural and desirable and good thing. A proposition with which I am in complete lack of agreement. It likewise proposes that you can fight violence with violence, a proposition which does not appeal logically to my mind. But I think more basically, it seems to me that we can hardly argue against arbitrary prejudice and discrimination if we are guilty of this ourselves. And of course the philosophy, as I understand it, espoused by the black Muslims, does involve simply meeting the problem of the white man's arbitrary prejudice by being arbitrary prejudiced against him,
white
which
devil.
Is yes, which is of course like saying if you see a mad dog coming down the street, the way to solve that problem is start foaming at the mouth yourself and run down the street and bite him first.
Yeah. That's pretty good. May I read you a quotation from Dr. Kenneth Clark, the psychologist, CCNY, on Dr. King and nonviolence? On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability, while that of the black nationalists, he'd been talking about the Muslims, betrays pathology and instability. But a deeper analysis might reveal that there is also an unrealistic, if not pathological, basis in King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice is bitterness and resentment. The form which such bitterness takes need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion which is involved is inevitable. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them places an additional and probably intolerable psychological burden upon the victims. How do you respond to that?
I could agree with that only if I were not a believing Christian.
Only if you were not a believing Christian.
If I were not a believing Christian, that is, that if I did not believe in the I can't think of the word. For want of a better word, I shall say, the improving effect of self-sacrifice. Then I would say that what Dr. Clark says is logically true. I of course agree with this. I would agree with something that he implied in there but didn't get around to, and that is that Dr. King's philosophy is not a single solution to the problem of human relations in the United States or in the world. I think for instance that Dr. King had a great deal of difficulty solving the problem which all of us have with regard to that part of his doctrine which says we observe only God's just law. We are entitled to break man-made laws if our conscience says they are wrong. Of course, it wasn't the originator of this, and
no.
He'd be the last man who ever said it either. And yet we strive to change man's laws, and then once they are changed, to exact obedience to those laws. If someone attempted to break them, we wouldn't talk about God's law first. We would talk about his breaking the man-made law first. This problem of the I don't know whether you'd use the word dichotomy or not, but anyway this problem of the conflict between God's law and man's law, and how man can reconcile the adherence to man's law with his conscience, at what point he can break. I think this is the more interesting thing about Dr. King's philosophy. But insofar as it being erosive or corrosive of anything in my pathology to tell me to love a man who hates me, I think that so far from being that, this improves a man, that it makes him a stronger man emotionally and intellectually.
James Baldwin writes about the Southern mob and the Southern majority will as follows. The most trenchant observers of the scene in the South, those who are embattled there, feel that the Southern mobs are not an expression of the Southern majority will. Their impression is that these mobs fill, so to speak, a moral vacuum, and that the people who form them would be happy to be released from them.
I don't agree with that.
You're not alone in not agreeing
with that. When I got the word that President Kennedy was dead, I happened to be in a group composed primarily of white men. These were, as a matter of fact, some of these men were officers of the United States government. And I caught, when this word first came, someone came to the room and said, came directly to me. I don't know why it came directly to me. I guess they thought I had more of an interest in President Kennedy living. Avon, the president has been seriously hurt in Texas. He's been shot in a parade. And I saw a white man with an unholy grin on his face when he heard it. And then he went on and said he was in a parade and Governor Connally and Vice President Johnson were also shot, critically injured. And all of a sudden the grin wiped off his face. This type of, I think that really epitomizes my answer to that question. This man was a respectable man. He was a high-ranking officer in the United States government. I would like to go back. I really didn't say what I should have said about this matter of loving those who hate you. I think that many of us misconceive what loving those who hate you means. Love does not mean what the white man has traditionally thought it meant. It does not mean being blind to his faults. It does not mean being afraid to tell him when he is wrong or when he's being stupid. It does not mean being afraid to fight him in a legitimate way. The love that I'm talking about, is the type of love which a very intelligent and Christian mother has for a child. For after all, as I see it, although the white man has accused the Negro of being the child in the American society, I think that if you look at it realistically, you will find that the white American has displayed the more childish tendencies. That is, he who has failed to accept, for instance, his violation of the Negro slave woman, a completely unrestrained and childish impulse that ignored any mature recognition of the facts of life or any insight into the future. The Negro woman, on the other hand, I think although she was unable to help herself, I think history teaches that she has come off far better in terms of demonstrating a maturity, a recognition of the responsibilities of life to herself and to her children, attests the fact that you have so many Negro men now who have gone so far in life as a result of some Negro mother washing and ironing and working hard to get that child into school and to get an advantage for him. So I say that love involves chastisement. And I think that the white American needs a whole lot of chastisement. It involves other forms of correction. It involves making an individual respect you, whether he wants to or not. It involves a whole lot of things that we don't think about when we talk about love, and I think Reverend King's philosophy has something to do with this. I think the fact that they don't draw back at all. But with regard to this very last thing that this quotation from Baldwin. Is this type of unrealistic thinking that wants to love the white man because he's pretty according to what he has taught us and he's intelligent and he's good according to what he's taught us. So we just overlook all the mean, evil traits in, for instance, a little elderly lady who here in Nashville who's a secretary over at the courthouse, 60 or 70 years old, just as sweet as she could be apparently. But every time she would get me by myself, she would try to start telling me about how race relations was bad and we wish we could go back to the old days and Negroes don't want this and all that. Now, this was mean. You see, this was not an admirable trait. There's no reason for us to try to relieve white people of the responsibility for the mobs which they permit to exist. You see, for the mistreatment which they permit to exist, for the evil in their own minds which they permit to exist. If we're going to relieve them of it, then this shows that we haven't even recognized the responsibility of driving similar ideas and similar evil out of our own minds. So I would say that is incorrect, but I would say that the solution to the problem is not condemnation. I would say the solution to the problem is to attempt to make the white society, which does not actively participate in the mobs. I think the ones who are in the mobs want to be there. But to attempt to make the majority of the white society, which does not participate in the mobs, recognize its responsibilities. For after all, that same white society has, since I was not even able to understand, has driven me to recognizing my responsibility for the shiftless Negro, for instance, the Negro drunk, the Negro community. Matter of fact, it will not even allow me to escape, or would not until I got accustomed to it, and now I don't want to escape. I wouldn't want to live in a white neighborhood now because I'm accustomed to having my people, I'm accustomed to some things that go on in my neighborhood that I wouldn't feel so comfortable without. But I don't want my son to become to be deprived of the freedom of selecting the community within which he lives. And interestingly enough, I heard a white man say this very recently, a white, very intelligent white man, a member of a faculty of one of our great southern universities. He said from the witness, this was Dr. Camp down at Sewanee. He's one of the plaintiffs in our school case now.
Yes.
One of the county attorney, the attorney for the school board, made the mistake of asking him in a preliminary hearing why he wanted his child to attend a desegregated school system. And he gave him a very short, succinct answer. He indicated that he was born in Virginia, and was deprived of his freedom to choose as a child, and he wanted his child not to be submitted to those same restrictions that on his mind and on his freedom of thought, that he wanted his child to be able to choose freely. And I think he meant by this freely in regard to all the facets and aspects and phases of life and living. And that includes the freedom to choose your friends and everything else.
We hear a lot about the stereotype of the Negro by the white man. It's sometimes a contradictory picture, but we know the quality of the stereotype.
Right.
He might be shiftless and dangerous and this and that, but they're all part of a stereotype, even though they're self-contradictions in the stereotype.
Right, and if there's anything more, and wait a minute, and if he has any of the admirable traits, this is nearly always an exception.
Now, what about the Negro stereotype of the white man?
Yeah.
What are the qualities of that stereotype?
The Negro stereotype of the white man is based on the same ignorance that the white man's stereotype of the Negro is based on. I would say that the major difference is that the Negro stereotype of the white man has been more or less an ignorance that he could not do anything about because he was shut entirely out of the white man's environment. The stereotype of the Negro was not something that the white man couldn't do anything about because he had too much freedom within the Negro's environment. The stereotype of the Negro was a deliberate stereotype in the sense that it accomplished mean and evil desire that the in my opinion, of course, this is arguable. I recognize the meanness and evilness of it, of the desire is arguable, but nevertheless, a desire to accomplish the end of eliminating the Negro from that environment in which the white man lived, except in terms of being unobservable. Now, you understand what I mean by that. There, but unobservable. I would say the Negro stereotype of the white man has been a euphemistic one, primarily. In other words, for instance, I've heard Negroes say, he's a good-looking boy, looks just like a white man. Yes, or he talks like a white person. Or he acts like a white person. And this is all a part of that same old brainwashing, or training, if you wish, but I don't think training is the adequate word, because it's emblazoned from virtually every billboard that we see and has been for age on end, our magazines, covers, toilet doors, television, radio, and of course television is improving recently, newspaper, everything stereotypes the white man as being the perfect individual.
Is there another stereotype opposite to that among Negroes for the white man? The cold, the cruel, the avaricious, the unimaginative?
I think, yes. I don't say that. I don't think this is a stereotype, because I think that the Negro, and this is one of our problems in race relations. I don't like the word stereotype here. I think the only thing that you can call a stereotype is this idea that has been brainwashed into the Negro that white is right. Mm-hmm. Now this, it's just what the Negro thinks of immediately. The American Negro thinks of immediately, subconsciously, before he has a chance to think about it. I think in terms, when you say stereotype, you refer to some concept that isn't necessarily true, that is imposed on a group.
That's right.
That is imposed on a group as being applicable to all members of that group without any individuality.
Yes, that's what I mean.
And I don't think you can get that any which way you go with regard to the American Negro, because he has, it's just contrary to his thinking. He has always dealt with the white man as an individual. He has thought in terms of the white man as an individual. When he talks about white people, it's in terms of the system, not in terms of the innate, of the particular characteristics of some particular man. For instance, the Negro will say, that's a mean white man. That's a good white man. He's just a mediocre white man. I think, in other words, what I'm saying is, and maybe white people wouldn't like to hear this, because I think this is really a mark of intelligence. But the Negro has been able to discriminate on an individual basis.
He had to, didn't he?
Between white men. I guess he had to. To a far greater extent. And very little stereotyping. As a matter of fact, the Negro has to keep telling himself not to trust this white man or that white man, because he has to tell himself, he has to be taught, really, that no matter how intelligent or how pleasant or how kind or how Christian any particular white man is, if there ever comes an issue, a basic issue, that relates to the identity of one white man to another, and I believe this, a white man will always stick with a white man.
Well, now, what about the Beckwith-Jewett trial? You're talking like my friend, the lawyer in New Orleans.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm not saying this in the sense of condemnation. I'm saying that this is a part of the childish selfishness which is taught a white child to continue as long until he's 70.
All right,
and
let's talk.
Let's talk them.
Go ahead. Let's talk them. Yeah, sure it is.
So I'm saying that it's very difficult for him to get away from it.
It may be difficult, but the question is whether any succeed. You see.
Oh well, now don't. I guess maybe that was an inner. Yeah, I shouldn't have said that really, because I don't believe there's anything that somebody can't succeed in. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it's a course. Of course. As a matter of fact, there are white people who, in my opinion, made far greater sacrifices for Negroes than many Negroes have been willing to make for themselves.
I ran into a strange thing. No, it's not strange at all. It's very natural and human, I guess. Lately in Mississippi, in my talks there with people, quite a few Negroes of different levels of intelligence and training have said the same thing. They have made different things of it. Mm. But then the whites who have come into the civil rights movement in Mississippi and Alabama have sometimes had it very rough, despite any sacrifices they were making. Now, this has been for different reasons. And I have had Robert Moses talk about this to me at length. He also said it and said some of the northern Negroes who had come in had it rough, who were tactless.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, there's been friction on this part of the white man coming in to this, say, SNCC or even any ACP activities.
Yes, I think this is definitely true.
They haven't had a real problem with this.
Yes, but my real quarrel, and I didn't really get to the heart of the thing, really, when I was discussing the other, discussing this same thing with you just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, but please do.
I think the real heart of it, the thing I was trying to hit when I said there is that you hardly find a white man who, when it comes down to something basic, when it comes down to his identity as a white man, that he will be with the white man. Now, I said that badly. What I should have said was, he would not rid himself of his white skin, of his identity as a white person. And I think this is related to what you're talking about.
It's related.
The same problem that that the white, of course, the white person who's in Mississippi catches more heck than a Negro, right, if he espouses this cause.
John
Siegenthaler likes to brag about the head he got beat in down in Montgomery, and I tell him, as a matter of fact, I told him this the other night, you have no right to brag to me or to complain to me because your head got beat in the interest of the Negro. Because your head didn't get beat in the interest of the Negro, it got beat in the interest of humanity. And when you say it got beat in the interest of the Negro and you say, Avon, you've got some responsibility, then you're depriving me of my individuality. So far as you know, my grandmother may have been white and my grandfather may have been white. If that be true,
well,
then I have a right to complain. I have a right to say to a Negro who's brown skinned or more brown skinned than I am, you ought to be prouder of me than you are of yourself when I put up with some privation in the interest of humanity because I'm lighter than you are. You see, what I'm trying to say is you are still going back to your pride and identity as a white person. You're still setting yourself off as God's chosen child. And I don't see anywhere in the Bible where it said a white skin made people God's chosen children.
One point of friction, though, that described to me not only by several people is the resentment at white people who tried to, quote, go Negro, you see, would come into the movement, take up a special Negro, what they conceive of Negro qualities, say about musical preferences, certain terms, certain ways of speech, certain attitudes. They assume to be Negro, then they absorb these.
Well, there again, I think the problem is whoever is resenting that is not recognizing that individual's right. Whether you call it, you don't even have to be a Christian to say God-given right. But I think if you just have any capacity to handle an idea or to think, you ought to recognize that by virtue of his being an individual, that an individual has a right to like things individually. Now, you can't, just because I like something that somebody has stereotyped as a Negro way of doing things or a Negro song, you can't tell me you don't have the right to cast an aspersion on that or say that I'm or to classify me even as a Negro because I do it. This is contrary, I think, to the basic individual human dignity. Of course, the thing that really makes this type of thinking ridiculous is that what happens 9 times out of 10 is that somebody smart comes along and gets some white person who is above reproach involved in some cheap imitation of the same thing, and it gets all the rage, and they start calling it they give it like rock and roll, for instance,
old
jazz and blues, your old Negro music, that's all. Rage all over Beatles, girls raising Cain about them last Sunday night. Now this is, why doesn't somebody say, well, this is Negro music. You white girls and boys, you forget about this. This will corrupt you. This is the, of course, this doesn't get to the heart. This is just the, shows the ridiculousness of stuff like that.
That's one of the points of resentment is based on the usage made of Negro music.
Why should I dislike opera? Why should I dislike grand opera? Just because, so far as I'm aware, no Negro has ever composed any grand opera that is considered to be. If I happen to individually like grand opera, that's my business, and no one should have the right to tell me I can't like it. If you don't recognize this, if any American fails to recognize this, taking it to its fullest extent, then he needn't prate about dictatorships and communist Russia or communist anything else, thought control or anything else, because this is what he is participating in. If you don't recognize an individual's right within the area of humane society to think the way he wants to think, to associate with the people, with whomever he would like to think, to associate, to be freely educated in that society, freely choosing and rejecting his companions within that society, and not on the basis of any stereotypes which society imposes, either by virtue of the state or by virtue of what is tantamount to the state group stereotypes and customs which achieve the status of law by virtue of various human factors.
In the light of what we know of social process, even revolutionary process, what is the content of the phrase meaning freedom now?
In the light of what?
Now, what we know of social process, even when it's accelerated to revolutionary process, it always involves a history of a movement in time. What is the content of the phrase freedom now?
I would say it's a battle cry. It's a battle cry. It means that nobody who has any sense, and just putting it that bald, and no Negro who has any sense, knowing the way we have seen so-called public officials operate since 1954, knowing the way we have seen so-called Christian white people in society, and I'm not condemning them, I'm just talking about looking at the facts,
knowing the way we have seen them operate since 1954, no Negro who has any sense is going to be unrealistic enough to think that without a fight, any appreciable segment of white society is going to give him anything. It means that many of us for a long time have realized we're in a fight. More and more of us have realized we're in a fight, and we've got a battle cry, and we will not be put off by promises that never come true.
How do you think the negotiations went here after the boycott?
Kind of badly at first. I was not a part of the negotiations. We just handled the lawsuit. So maybe I shouldn't try to express an opinion on that.
Well, you think either on the record or off the record, or it doesn't matter to me. I mean, I'm just curious to know what your feelings are on that.
I would say that on the off the record, I would say that negotiations in Nashville started off in a modest way. That during the course of those negotiations, the attitudes and thinking of some very powerful white people were modified, not changed, modified. And that modification permitted subsequent negotiations, which have been more fruitful, but not half as fruitful as they ought to.
In other words, a lot remains to be done.
Yes, a whole lot remains to be done in Nashville.
But was there a precedent set for the process, do you think?
Yes. The precedent of involvement of important businessmen and financial figures in the negotiating process. Yes.
They've reached the point where responsible people have to be involved. They can't stay out. Is that the key gain?
Well, it all depends on what you mean by have to be and can't stay out. These people, I think, come in simply because they feel they've begun to feel for the first time that they have a financial interest in preserving peace.
That's the point. The pressure's on them to preserve peace.
Yes, it's a financial pressure more than anything else. I think if it were a question of merely preserving public peace, I think you'd see a whole lot of Negro children still sitting over there in jail since 1960.
It's self-interest, and, financial self-interest, you mean?
Right. If the Negro hadn't used the weapon of the economic boycott, and if that weapon were not always there, these biracial committees that are getting all the headlines and all the credit about quiet progress now would probably have never existed in the composition that they exist, and they wouldn't have made one-fourth as much progress.
You don't lead except in strength, in other words.
That's correct. Sort of like the same proposition that we have in dealing with the Russians in the Cold War. It's all very well to say, and I believe in negotiating and bargaining to preserve the peace, but at the same time, you don't have anything to bargain with unless you have some strength, and when you have strength, you don't sit around and bargain away your basic rights and basic principles.
I know you want to go home. I should like very much to...